Alright, Erev Tov to everyone. Rochel Amazinin. We're looking tonight at the centurion of the 14th century, sponsored, as always, by Becky Navikatz, Le'il Nishmas Yona, Ben Reb Arye Leib, Zichron Livracha. The achievements of the 14th century for the Jewish people, if not life itself in the 14th century, were truncated because of the dominant event that transformed Jewish life and even world history, and that's the horror of the Black Death, the bubonic plague that descended on Europe right in the middle of the century. European life was devastated, with a death rate approaching half the population. The estimates are maybe a third to a half of the world population died, hundreds of millions of people, a staggering total, in a very short time, beginning in 1348, for approximately 3 years. Hundreds of millions of people died. The plague infiltrated Europe through fleas that were born by rat-infested ships coming from China that had docked in Genoa, Italy, as well as through overland cargo along the Silk Road. And the plague spread through cities and towns, through the water, and then the air, and claimed innumerable victims. Again, we're talking medieval times without any rhyme or reason they could associate with it. Killing the rich and the poor, nobility and the common man, killing the religious, seven cardinals alone died in Avignon, and killing the impious as well. It killed non-Jews, and it also killed Jews. But notwithstanding the latter, Christian Europe was rife with allegations, with the accusation that the plague was originated by Jews and spread by Jews for the purpose of killing Christians. So, of course, it was baseless, but Jews who had died by the thousands nonetheless did die in lower numbers than the Christians did, for reasons that only became fully clear years later. In retrospect, we can understand what it was. If the plague was spread by air and water due to poor hygiene, then Jews really were atypical from the rest of society in that halacha imposed upon us a hygienic regimen that was unknown to non-Jews. So, for example, until today, Jews are regularly washing our hands. We wash our hands before we eat bread. We wash before we daven. We wash after going to the bathroom. We're always washing our hands. Well, that itself cleanses. Jewish neighborhoods did not usually have open sewers, as you had in the rest of society, because tefillah requires a distance, at least dalet amos, from the sight and the odor of refuse. And most importantly, in this context, almost as important as the hand washing, Jews bury their dead immediately, avoiding the further spread of disease. Whereas Christians, ad hayom, let bodies linger for days, and in the context of the time, it just spread the bacteria even further. So Jews were perceived as dying less frequently, and therefore, despite the efforts of some popes and bishops to defend the Jews, Clement VI, who was a sophisticated fellow for his time, university educated, stands out in this regard, it was to no avail. And right after the Black Death, Jews were slaughtered in a wave of pogroms that ravaged the Jewish communities in Central Europe, Germany, Austria, Bohemia. And therefore, in the latter half of the century, Jewish life really dwindled, and our achievements dwindled as well. Jewish life in Europe stagnated in the second half of the 14th century. Rebuilding was very difficult, but there are two interesting and far-reaching takanos enacted that would shape Jewish life in the future. Reb Meir ben Baruch Halevi became the Rav in Vienna, and almost by default, the leading gadol of his time. So he saw the difficulty in providing spiritual leadership to the far-flung and decimated Jewish communities, and he saw as well that charlatans and imposters, Amei HaAretz, were taking control of those communities. So Meir Bar Halevi decreed firstly that only Rabbanim with smicha could assume leadership over those communities, what was called then and today Heter Hara. That is to say, there was a metric that thenceforth was used, universally accepted, to determine who was fit for leadership. Hetaro, we call in shorthand today smicha. So that really was a takana of Rav Meir ben Baruch Halevi of Vienna. Secondly, he enacted as well that rabbis be paid by their communities a salary commensurate with their duties and not have to rely on outside income. For that alone is Zocher L'Tov. But because of the plague, the greatest influences on Jewish life had to have lived earlier in the century, because life to a great extent stopped in the second half of the century. And the influences made their mark in a way that really was standard procedure. Gadol B'Torah, whose leadership and scholarship and Sfarim defined the era. So for his story, our centurion for the 14th century, we have to return for a moment to the previous century and look at the life of Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel, known to us as the Rosh. Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, was born approximately 1250 in Germany into the world of what was called the Hasidei Ashkenaz, the pious ones of Ashkenaz, the spiritual leaders of German Jewry, who emphasized pursuit of holiness in one's personal life, an intense fidelity to halacha, and an oblivious to the world at large, except when it forcefully intruded itself on Jewish society. They're perfectly content to hermetically seal themselves, if such a thing is possible, in their Avodas Hashem, in their Talmud Torah, and ignore everything else. What was unique about the Rosh is that his life straddled the worlds of Ashkenaz and Sfarad in a way that was very rare. Straddled the worlds of both Halacha and Musar, and he therefore defined an era that was bounded by persecution on one side and the ravages of the Black Death on the other. The Rosh was a Talmud first of his father, Reb Yechiel, his older brother, Reb Chaim, and then primarily of the one acknowledged as the Gadol Hador, the Maharam Mirotenberg, Reb Meir of Rotenberg, who lived from 1215 to 1293. The Maharam had the leading yeshiva then in Worms and Vermeisa, where the Rosh learned with other giants among the Maharam's Talmidim, known to us, the Mordechai, for example, Mordechai ben Hillel, whose parish on the Talmud is in the back of every Masechta, Reb Chaim or Zarua, and others as well. His life had a tragic end in which the Rosh was involved when the government imposed harsh confiscatory taxes on the Maharam personally, as well as other Jews. He fled the country in disguise, but he was arrested anyway in 1286, and he was imprisoned by the Emperor Rudolf I, who held him for ransom. The Maharam refused to allow the Jewish community to ransom him, fearing that would only encourage more such abductions. And in line with what the Mishnah says in the fourth parak of Gittin, Ein poden es ashruyim yoseh akadei demehen mipnei tikkun olam. We don't liberate the captives, redeem the captives, for more than their value, because of tikkun olam. Tikkun olam means because the world needs to live a certain way. The whole concept is really lost today. The obligation is we have to do what we can within reason to liberate prisoners, but what's unreasonable will just provoke more such kidnappings, and in fact makes the world chaotic, makes the world unlivable, and Jewish life unlivable. But it's very hard, especially today, because obviously lives are at stake, and you have families who are very prominent and outspoken, and naturally so. Many well-meaning people who have become public advocates for Gilad Shalit, for example, for his release at any price, may have indirectly prolonged his incarceration. I don't know if you may have read, but just last week, Yuval Diskin, who recently retired as the head of the Shin Bet, he said that 2 years ago they had an agreement to release Shalit in exchange for 1,000 prisoners. And at the time, there were daily rallies in Israel calling for his release at any price. No mechir, any mechir. That was the slogan. At which point, Hamas then raised the price. They heard the society demands his release at any price, so they raised the price. And Diskin said he cut off negotiations. Because you can't deal with someone who thinks you'll pay any price. Whenever you agree, the price just then goes up. And all your interests will be lost. So the Maharam believed in this. He felt that he would be ransomed, so they just kidnap him another time, or kidnap someone else another time. And the Jewish community would become bankrupt. He eventually died in prison. He was in prison for 7 years. He died in 1293, at which point the emperor tried to ransom off his body. Also something the Arabs do today. It wasn't until 14 years after his death in 1307 that the Maharam's body was redeemed by one wealthy Jew who wanted to be buried next to him, and he was brought to Jewish burial. The Maharam had appointed the Rosh a Dayan in Worms. And the Rosh also made a very good living as a banker, what for some reason non-Jews derided as a moneylender. I mean, no one criticizes Bank of America's moneylenders today, but that's what they do. That's what the Rosh was. He was a banker, in addition to being the Dayan. And he, in fact, spearheaded the efforts to try to free his Rebbe, even offering most of his substantial assets, all to no avail. The Maharam refused. With the Maharam indisposed and then deceased, so the Rosh became the de facto spiritual leader of German Jewry. Now that had two immediate consequences. First, the Rosh guided German Jewry through another catastrophe, the Rindfleisch massacres that decimated the Jews of southern Germany beginning in 1298. Rindfleisch was a German knight who, owing a debt to the Jewish community that he could not repay, fabricated a message from heaven that he had been commanded by God to slaughter the Jews. And he found no shortage of other knights who would join him in this campaign. Rindfleisch took advantage of a civil war that was then raging in Germany between two rivals for the throne of Germany. So beginning on Yud Dalet Av in 1298, Rindfleisch and his band called Judenschachters, Jew Slaughterers, marched through Germany and Austria, excuse me, annihilating every Jewish community except for two, Regensburg and Augsburg, where they were protected by the local bishops, killing in just about 6 months over 100,000 Jews. Among the murdered was the aforementioned Mordechai, who was murdered in Nuremberg together with his whole family. The Rosh somehow escaped, and he was instrumental in restoring some order to German Jewish life, especially as it regarded the distribution of the estates of murdered Jews who left no heirs. So he in fact took a lead role in assuring that property would find some orderly distribution and not simply descend into Hefker. But with his prominence came the fear that he too would suffer the Maharam's fate, suffer his Rebbe's fate. And the Rosh, and this is pretty rare for the time, decided to escape Germany in 1303, leaving behind most of his fortune. I apologize, I'm still on the lingering effects of my illness from a few weeks ago. So the Rosh first went to southern France, finally arriving in Spain in the year 1306. He was greeted very warmly in Barcelona by the aged Rashba of Shlomo ben Aderes, who's one of the giants of Spanish Jewry, been a Talmud of the Ramban, and was the chief rabbi of Barcelona. Now, they'd never met. It's interesting, but typical. The Rashba knew of the Rosh. They'd corresponded for years already, but it's one of those rare cases in medieval times when, in fact, the Ashkenazi and Sephardi worlds intersected. Travel itself was almost non-existent for such distances, except when required by persecution, I suppose commerce as well, and communication was difficult. So you don't find always necessarily that the Gedolim of Ashkenaz were aware of the Gedolim of Sfarad. Certainly not in the 10th and 11th centuries. By now a little more, but it was very rare they would actually meet. Even rarer that one would go from a residence in Ashkenaz to residence in Sfarad. Now, fortunately, the Jews of Spain were enjoying a period of relative calm at this point, at the beginning of the 14th century. Everything would literally blow up at the end of the century with the beginning of the persecutions of the Inquisition and the massacres of 1391. But now things were calm, and the Rashba, who was towards the end of his life, had the Rosh appointed the chief rabbi of Toledo, a walled city in south central Spain that enjoyed a flourishing Jewish community. So there the Rosh became the Rav, he became the Dayan of the city as well, and he became a world resource for Chuvos, the authority in Spain, as well as in Western Europe, all compiled in what became the Shut HaRosh, the Shilas HaChuvos of the Rosh. In Spain, he was considered a successor to the Rashba, who died in 1310. Now, if you think that an Ashkenazi Rav would be out of place in a Spanish milieu, you'd be correct. The Rosh dominated Toledo, but he did find it difficult to accommodate some of the differences between Germany and Spain. One area was the study of philosophy, that old bugaboo. It was unknown and largely considered unnecessary and even dangerous in Germany, but as we see already from before the Rambam's time, was part of life in Spain. The Rosh railed against it without success. He writes, for example, in his Truvas, in Klal Nun Hei Simon Tes, V'alze Omer HaChacham, about this, Shlomo said, Kol Bo'eha Lo Yishuvun. Actually, it's a Navi. Kol Bo'eha Lo Yishuvun, those who go down that path will not return. In fact, the pasuk that Elisha ben Avuya said about himself, the Gemara says in Chagiga. Rotza Lomar, Kol Abo V'nichnas Mitchila B'chochma Zo, a person who goes down, enters ab initio into this wisdom, lo yuchal lotzeis mimena likaneis b'libo chochmas ha-Torah. He'll never be able to extricate himself to be able to have the wisdom of Torah. Ki lo yuchal lashuv mechochma tivisha hurgal bo. He'll never again revert to the natural intuition, the seichel that a person has, common sense, which is inborn. He'll always be thinking in the philosophical categories. Because of this, he'll never attain the real wisdom of Torah, which is the way of life. He'll not always be on other wisdoms, natural wisdom, philosophical wisdom, and always be wanting to harmonize the both, find the common areas, and to bring proofs one to the other. Through this he'll corrupt the din. They're really two opposites. Tsaro zolozo. They're adversaries. They can't dwell in the same place. That's a current of thought that's existed from before the Rosh's time down to our time as well. I remember hearing years ago, I think it was Rav Aaron Cutler who said that anyone who has a PhD should not be allowed to pass in a shaila. You don't have to agree necessarily, but you understand that mindset, it was really classical of Hasidei Ashkenaz, because they felt the two disciplines were incompatible, and therefore one's mind would not be able to compartmentalize, to understand Torah on its own terms. The Rosh was also shocked to discover that Batei Din in Spain carried out capital punishment. Those were the days. The government gave the Jewish community complete jurisdiction over Jewish life. As it is, non-Jewish kings rarely balked if Jews wanted to kill each other, it saved them the trouble. But, and this included the power to execute Jewish criminals. So the Rush tried to stop it, even writes about it, but he could not, and he acceded to some of the executions that took place. So you might ask, how could the Beis Din execute Jews in the absence of the Sanhedrin and the Lishkas HaGozis? So the answer is, Tzorech Shoh. The only in what they consider to be exigent circumstances and the needs of the moment, if the guilty are wanton sinners and the like. And in fact, this is Halacha brought down in Shulchan Aruch in Chashan Mishpat, Simon Beis, right at the beginning. Kol Beis Din, afilu einam smuchim Eretz Yisrael. Any Beis Din, even those not ordained the smicha from in Eretz Yisrael, imroim she'om perutzim ba'averos. If they see the people are just rife with sin, u'shut sarach shah, and it's in need of the moment, hayudanin bein nisa bein mamon. Beis Din can judge them, whether capitally or monetarily. Now, of course, the Rosh had come from an environment where killing Jews was a non-Jewish sport. See, he could never accept that executions should be a normative part of Jewish life, except he writes regarding informers. But nonetheless, they did it, and he was shocked to find out that they did it. Interestingly, the Rosh endeavored to maintain Minhage Ashkenaz even in Spain, to propagate them in Spain, because he held them to be superior to the customs of the Sfardim. By the way, it's exactly opposite of what, for example, HaChacham Ovadia says today, that the customs of the Sfardim are superior to those of the Ashkenazim, and therefore the Ashkenazim should change. The Rosh was such a powerful figure that many of the customs of Hasidei Ashkenaz were adopted by Spanish Jewry under his leadership. He also, he also introduced to Spain the method of Talmud Torah that was popular in Germany, and for that purpose he compiled the Tosfos HaRosh. You have some pills, I'm open to that also. There's always a catch. Like most of the great spiritual leaders of Jewish life, the Rosh is primarily known to us through his writings. So I mentioned before the Shas and Shuvos. You have also the Tosfos HaRosh, which is about the last of the Tosfos written on the Gemara. You have it usually in a separate sefer, the Tosfos HaRosh. His most famous work, of course, was his commentary on the Talmud that's printed in every large Shas, and usually right after the end of the Masechta, the commentary of the Rosh. The Rosh would cite the Gemara's various opinions, and then usually the Rif. Some say he saw his commentary as an updating of what the Rif did. Then he'd bring the explanations of the Rishonim, the Baalei Tosfos, until his time. He would give his opinion, later compiled by his own son Rabbi Yaakov, as the Piskei HaRosh. You find this in the Shas as well, right after the Rosh, his Piskei Halacha. So essentially it was an updated riff. So the Rosh omitted most of the Gemara's discussions and most of the Agoda as well. But it's interesting, it's like a running commentary in which he's choosing here and there and making points relevant. So just give one example. As I opened up a Rosh before, at the very beginning of the Shas, in Bravos, Me'emos Haktaronis, Kriya Shema Arvis. When is the time that you start saying Kriya Shema at night? And the Mishnah says you say it until either Chatzos or Kol HaLaila. So from that beginning, the Rosh clarifies both opinions. And then he says, he quotes Yerushalmi, that our shuls daven ma'ariv too early, and therefore our kriya shema of arvis were yotze with kriya shema lamita. So then he begins a discussion of, if that's the case, then why don't we say a bracha on that kriya shema shalamita? Mela, during the davening, we don't have to, because the bracha is preceding kriya shema. But if you're saying kriya shema fulfillment of the mitzvah later, why not say a bracha? And then he quotes the Ritzigun Gias, and he quotes Rabbeinu Tam, says not to say it, but this is the style of the riff, of the rush rather, and then he gives his opinion, and this is on, you know, almost all the Masechtos and Shas. excluding those that deal, like most of those who, except for the Rambam, with matters of Eretz Yisrael, Korbanos, etc. Now, rather than create a new system of classification like the Rambam did, the Rosh just restored the primacy of the Gemara itself, and he became the indispensable guide to Talmud study and Psak Halacha for several centuries. He also wrote on the Sechtos, on which there was no riff, some of them are hidden. You have to be a detective sometimes, where you find certain commentaries of the Rosh in areas where we wouldn't expect them. So for example, so there really is no Rosh on Zvachim or Menachos, but appended to Menachos, the Rosh wrote what he called Halachos Ketanos, on the laws of Sefer Torah, all the discussion of Gemara, but Sefer Torah, Mezuzah, Tefillin, Tzitzis, Tumah, Challah, Kilayim, and others as well. The Rosh also wrote a very small, concise Musa work, very famous and popular Musa work, called the Orchos Chaim, the Paths of Life. It's a beautiful little Sefer. It's basically, I guess we say today, bullet points, divided into seven chapters, one to be read each day of the week. These are all helpful reminders on how to live a good and decent life, how to be a Shomer Mitzvah, how to be a Yirei Shamayim. Each chapter can be read in 5 minutes. So just like 20, 30 points per day that people should think about. Most of them are traits to avoid, things not to do. Some of them are obvious Isurim, but nonetheless they need reminders, reinforcements. Starting with avoiding, just starts, you have to avoid arrogance and chanifus, flattery, frivolity, anger, etc. And he has other things, just you read during the day, well, you read it each day, and they're just good reminders. Here, tonight is already Yom Shlishi. He says in the Yom Shlishi, Mikol machal asher tochal, umikol mashke asher tishteh, whatever you eat, whatever you drink, Al tehaneh below bracha tchilo v'sof. Don't enjoy it unless you say a bracha first and a bracha afterwards. V'chavein bo kasher tuchal, and your kavana should be appropriate. Don't just run through the bracha, spit out the bracha, say the bracha with kavana. V'chaseh roshcha kishet tazkiras Hashem, and cover your head, which wasn't always common amongst the Jews of Ashkenaz or Sfarad. Cover your head when you mention God's name. V'tizgor einecha, close your eyes when you're saying the bracha. Ki midei dabercha bo, when you speak of him, al tika amur b'fiv u'visfasov chabduni v'libo rachok mimeni. Don't be of those of whom it's said that they just speak from the mouth, and their lips, they honor me with their lips, but their heart is very distant from me. But turn every act of eating into a holy act, into a godly act by mentioning God. Or, Al takum imitaschok isha tzel. Don't get up in the morning like a lazy person. You know, the alarm goes off and you just linger in bed for a little while. Kim bizrizus kedei lava liyotzrecha. But you have to get up assiduously with energy to serve your Creator. Or Al tisasek b'mitzvah kedei lekabel pras. Al terachek min averos mipnei haonesh. Don't be involved in mitzvos for some reward. Don't keep far from sins because of the punishment. Rak avod me'ava, serve God with love. Just little hints. Lahavdil, Ben Franklin became famous for these later in the Farmer's Almanac, for many of them at least. But here's the Rush. In all, 131 different hints, divided across 6 days, and then special directives for Shabbos. The Rush had 8 sons. Most famous of his sons, Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim. Rabbi Yaakov, born in 1275 in Germany like his father, died in 1340 in Toledo like his father. So Rabbi Yaakov studied with his father and his older brother Yechiel. His brother Rabbi Yehuda ben Arash succeeded the Rush as the Rav in Toledo. So Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim just sat and learned and wrote and wrote. So, of course, many know as the Balaturim on the Torah, but his monumental work that also transformed Jewish life in a way that, you know, we take it for granted now, but it's such an amazing construction The Arba Turim, the four columns, the four pillars. It was the Rosh Hashanah who divided all of Halacha into four broad subject matters that from our perspective later became associated mainly with the Shulchan Aruch. But it really came from Rabbi Yaakov Balatur and the Tur. Aruch Chaim, the laws of daily life, and Tefillah, and Shabbos, and Yom Tovim, etc. Yoredeya, dealing with Kashrus, and Nidon, Aveilus, and related matters. Milah, Geirus, etc. Evan Ezra, dealing with family and marriage. And Chash and Mishpat, dealing with the laws of Mamonos. All halachos that a person will access in life, he further divided into chapters, and it became a running commentary. That's the tour, with the Gemara's statement, and then all the opinions to date, and the tour's opinion. Whenever there was a conflict, and including hundreds of times, the very simple statement, the Aleph dash Aleph Harosh Zal, the Adoni Ovi Harosh Zal said so and so. My father, my master, the Rosh of blessed memory said such and such. So the tour exceeded his father's commentary on the Gemara in the sense that it was arranged according to subject matter and therefore was much more easily accessible. So in fact, the tour deviated from his father, wasn't just on the Gemara, and adopted more of the Rambam's approach. The Rambam really had Kedarko Bakodesh, his own way of systemizing the Torah, of arranging the Halacha. Became more natural for us to follow the order of the tour, and the tour became the predicate for it. The tour, the beginning of the tour, is the beginning of the what we know as the Shulchan Aruch. He's Gaber Kari, a person gets up in the morning. He starts with the laws of Hashkama Saboker. You get up in the morning, you have certain obligations, and that's how a Jew lives his life. The tour became the predicate for not only dozens of commentaries, but eventually for the Shulchan Aruch itself. Rabbi Yosef Karo, whom we'll revisit in a few weeks, wrote a commentary on the tour called the Beis Yosef, in which he discussed the tour's conclusions and he supplemented whatever reasoning the tour had, disagreed when he felt appropriate, and offered a psak halacha on each area that the tour left open or where he disagreed. In case of dispute, the Beis Yosef writes in the Hakdama, by a majority of the three great decisors, poskim, that he used, he writes that there are three amude hora, pillars of authority, on whom Beis Yisrael rely: Halohema, Harif, the Harambam, the Harosh, the Rif, the Rambam, and Rosh. And the Beis Yosef said he states the halacha as following the opinion of at least two out of the three. In most cases, sometimes we'll just adopt the Rambam's opinion, but most of the time, the Beis Yosef adopted whatever the majority was, and this was later synopsized into the Shulchan Aruch. So, in fact, you see where the Rosh stood in the pantheon, so to speak, of Jewish life. You have the Rif and the Rambam and the Rosh as well. That was the esteem in which the Rosh was held by his contemporaries and by later generations. And also the great impact that the Rosh had on Jewish life directly and then through his son, Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim. The Rosh died in 1327 in Toledo, and his life, which spanned two different centuries and two different locales and even modes of Jewish life, reflected almost the end of the flourishing of Spanish Jewry. There's no doubt that in terms of Yehudei Ashkenaz, when the Rosh left, the community declined somewhat, and then when the Black Death came in 1348, so that community itself was greatly weakened for almost a century after that. But in Spanish Jewry as well, the Rosh's life represented a high point of sorts. In the 14th century, the Rivosh, who was a later contemporary of the Rosh, Rav Yitzchak Bar Sheshes, towered over the rest of his generation in Saragossa, then in Valencia, writing thousands and thousands of Truvos. before he himself had to flee Spain to Algeria to escape the pogroms of 1391. With those pogroms and the Black Death in Europe in mid-century, the Russia's life marked a high point for both German and Spanish Jews that in many respects they would never regain. And that in itself makes him a very unique figure. But the beneficiaries of his life, all those who learned from him and from those he taught, ensure that the legacy of the Rosh remains eternal and powerful in the Jewish world. That is Rabbeinu Osher ben Yechiel, our centurion of the 14th century. Next time we meet, actually in 2 weeks, we'll have a few in March, we'll probably finish right after Pesach, we'll look at the centurion of the 15th century. I thank you all very much. So again, 2 weeks from tonight. Thank you.